Then if you want to make something, you have to learn how to make it, is that it, Monsignor?
Very much so.
Do you think you could make a table like that, this very minute?
I'm sure I couldn't.
No, neither could Ruth nor I. Ruth makes tapestries, you've seen some of them here, Roger, but she makes them on a machine, itself made by an expert, with materials also made by experts. But they're nonetheless real for that. How do you suppose the flowers and things come?
I haven't the faintest notion.
Would you care to see some being made?
I should, very much indeed.
Then let us go and call on the man or one of them who does it. As we made our way thither, we explained to Roger that the friend upon whom we were calling keeps what on earth would be called a nursery garden, that when he was incarnate he had done similar work.
I imagined, said Roger, that the flowers grew here in much the same way as on earth from seed, and so on.
That doesn't appear to be so from what you say.
What happens, then?
Let us wait until we get there, Roger, and our friend will tell you all about it.
Look, now, you can see where the gardens are. In front of us we could perceive great tracts of brilliant colors, each color separate, stretching far away in field after field. There were trees of all kinds in every stage of growth, from mere saplings to veritable patriarchs. We followed a path that led directly to a large house. As I had already sent a message to the owner of the nursery, he was awaiting our arrival. Roger was therefore surprised when the opening words of our friend clearly indicated that he already knew of our impending visit. Ruth briefly told Roger about the thought process of sending messages, to which he replied by saying that that was something further that had to be investigated. We introduced Roger to our host as a new arrival who was following the usual procedure of seeing things for himself.
So you've come to see the flowers made, young friend.
Well, you've come to the right place, he said with a merry twinkle. Roger had by now completely overcome any shyness he may have had, and plied people with questions with a right goodwill. He commenced operations at once upon our gardener friend.
Do you supply the flowers for all these lands?
He queried.
Oh, no.
Only for this area, as you might call it. There's lots more people doing the work in other parts. This is just one. Now where shall we begin?
First come and see some of our products.
Surrounding us were hundreds of flower beds, each containing a different kind of flower, and each ranged in orderly rows. We don't make any attempt to be properly artistic in what we call our stock beds, though, mind you, the colors themselves attract great admiration, as well as the long lines of flowers and plants. It is the masses of flower and color that folk find so fascinating. Our own gardens, over yonder, we laid out for pure pleasure purposes. We noticed particularly the enormous number of blooms that grew upon a single stem of each plant.
You see, explained the gardener, in the old earth plants the flowers fade in due course, and seed pods form, so that you might have half the stem with blooms and half with seeds. You can see for yourself that, without this happening, and the whole stem being filled with blooms for its right length, there's no comparison.
There's nowhere else but here, I mean, the spirit world, where flowers could be grown like these. Cast your eye on those hollyhocks. Did you ever see such beauties as those, with blooms from the top reaching down all that way? And no fading or dying. That's how we make them, and that's how they stay. As far as we could see, were beds upon bed of such perfect flowers as incarnate I never beheld. Ruth and I had visited this beautiful place often before, but to Roger it was new, and such a revelation as to hold him almost speechless. There were flowers of every variety known on earth, all the old cherished blooms that have been familiar to earth folk time out of mind, the old-fashioned flowers, as one liked to regard them, the hollyhocks and pansies, the snapdragons, Canterbury bells, and wallflowers, stocks, and a hundred other kinds. As may be imagined, the scent from this great collection was superb, not overpowering, but sufficient to make its presence pleasantly felt, and enjoyable. You can understand this work is more like a holiday when you compare it to the labor that would be required on earth for such large gardens as these. I doubt if there are any as big as these on earth, and these aren't the biggest by any means. Still, we have everything that may be called for here. As I was saying, it's more like a holiday here. We're no bothered with all the troubles of things on earth, the weather for instance, most of all the weather, or the right soil, and everything to do with the planting, and so on. It's a long process on earth from the moment the seed is planted to the time you come to pick the blooms for the market. But here, bless you, we make our plant with its blooms already on it, in all varieties and mixtures of colors. We can have single blooms or double, as we fancy, or as others fancy. And on we have made them and planted them out. Well, there's nothing more to do, so to speak. But weren't idle for all that, even if it's merely showing people round. You would think, Roger, I said, that our gardener here had precious little to do. Don't be deceived. He is the genius behind all our gardens, the designer in chief. He and his colleagues, brothers in the art, are responsible for the loveliness of the many gardens you've seen. We followed our guide along path after path, from flowerbeds to avenues of trees and shrubs. The superabundance seemed overwhelming, but our friend assured us that everything we saw would be put to good use, and was not there merely for display. Roger put a question to him. If the flowers and trees never fade and die, he asked, how is it so many are wanted? The demand must be enormous. You are right, the demand is enormous. Some people like to expand their gardens, or put in new beds. That's one way we come in. Then there are the gardens in the city. They're often reconstructed or otherwise changed about. So we come in again. Then people feel the urge to change what's growing in their gardens, and we supply them with new stuff, bringing back here what they have discarded. When you come to look around you, you can see there's still plenty of room to make more beds and fill them. Now come indoors, and see some of our treasures. We were shown into a spacious apartment containing many shelves filled with large volumes. Our friend took down one volume and opened it at random. It showed a picture of a tulip, exquisitely drawn in color. It was not an artistic reproduction in the strict sense of the term, it was a purely botanical picture, without background, and revealed full details of the flower and its foliage, so that anyone viewing it would know exactly how the flower was composed. Especially true was the coloring of it, so we were informed. It is from these paintings that our pupils learn all the details of the flowers before they commence the actual process of creation. Before you can begin to build a flower, or anything else, if it comes to that, you must know precisely all the details necessary for a faithful reproduction. Near enough is not good enough. It's got to be perfect. And the only way to make it so is to know by heart every twist or turn of the object that is to be created. You could take it right off the drawing, so to speak. In fact, that is what the beginner always does. But afterwards, he will study the picture or an original, if he prefers it, and that leaves him free, when the work commences, to devote his whole mind to the object in hand. In all these volumes you will find colored pictures of every flower we make here, both the earthly kinds and those that belong to the spirit world alone. In addition to these books, we have the prints hanging separately on the walls in another room. That's done for the convenience of anyone who wishes to view them without looking through the volumes. Come across the hall into the big room. We entered a very large chamber where, hanging upon the walls, were magnificent pictures of every type of garden to be seen in these lands. It was impossible to assess the greater beauty of any one over that of another. They were all equally wonderful. Most of these gardens, our host pointed out, have actually been built somewhere or other in this area. Inventive faculties don't seem to have any limit, as you can see. Some of these sketches have been presented to us from other nursery gardens, in the same way as we pass on drawings and sketches that portray some particularly happy novelty. A regular exchange goes on, for you know, young friend, in these lands we are always on the move in things. We don't stick in the mud. At length our gardener friend led us into a smaller room where there were a number of young people busily occupied, and we were told that these were pupils in the art of horticulture. We perceived that Roger had all this time been immensely attracted and interested in what he was being shown. Not that he had exhibited any sign of boredom hitherto, but here there was an especial attraction, which, to the eyes of Ruth and me and the gardener, showed very plainly that he would like to take up this work himself. Our friend at last brought us to the climax of our visit, the actual creation of a flower. For this purpose he seated us around him, while he placed upon a table a small vessel similar to the ordinary flower pot. Into this he poured some soil, and without further preliminary, he requested us to watch the vessel upon the table. At first there was little to be seen beyond a slight haze of light round about the pot. Gradually, however, this formed itself into a distinct shape, which one could see was the outline of a stem with a flower upon it. This became more and more firm, until there was the complete adumbration of a flower, even to the color, though this latter was as yet rather pale. But there was sufficient formation to be able to observe unmistakably the kind of flower it was, namely, a tulip. The gardener rose from his seat, took up the pot, and examined it minutely, before he pronounced his satisfaction, and then passed it round for us to inspect. It was a beautiful object, shapely yet delicate, so that one could see clearly through it. I handed it back to its creator, who placed it upon the table once more, and with one final effort of concentrated thought brought the flower up to its full solidity and color, with apparently little effort. "There you are, Roger. There's a nice flower for you. Can you see anything wrong with it?" The boy replied that he could see absolutely nothing whatever the matter with it. "There is, though. Monsignor and Ruth know, but we have not let you into the secret yet." Roger re-examined the tulip, but again confessed himself unable to detect anything amiss. "As a flower merely to look at, it's the best we can do, but there is something missing. There is no animation to preserve it. We can't give I or any flower, that must come from another realm, and we don't ask for it until we are sure that what we have made is fitted to receive it. Oh, we make our mistakes, you know, especially my young pupil boys and girls. You expect to have some mishaps when you are learning, but no harm is done. We return the elements to their source, and begin again. Sometimes we find a petal, for instance, has not been shaped truly. Perhaps one side of the bloom is a shade higher than the other, or the color may not be exactly as we want it, and so we have to begin again. My students find an enormous amount of pleasure in their learning, but the greatest satisfaction comes when they are fully proficient, and can turn out a flower or plant as perfect as the picture." "How does the animation come?" asked Roger. "Do you have to perform some sort of service for it?"
"Do you mean a religious service?"
"Yes, something of the kind."
"Oh, no. What we do is to send to that higher realm I mentioned, where someone receives our message. After that, all we know is that there is a rapid descent of the power we ask for. Of course, originally, it comes from the source, but it is passed on to us from another personage. It is a natural process and procedure, and the fact that we have created the flower or plant is sufficient. Our desire for its complete animation is fulfilled, our request is answered without fail, and without question. We shouldn't ask for it for an inferior article, though we could have it even for that, but our natural pride wouldn't allow us to do so. At first I examine all my pupils' work. If any slight modification or improvement is needed, that can be done, but if it's too bad for improvement, then it's started anew, and the malformed work is discarded. It's very simple when once you are in the running of it, so to speak. As with many other things, it's easy when you know how. I shouldn't like to say that at least as far as I'm concerned, I said. I'm convinced I should turn out a flower such as had never been seen before, and was never likely to be seen again. Oh, come now, Monsignor. Would you like to try for yourself?
Indeed, I should not. I should be far too nervous, especially with the three of you gazing at me and waiting for trouble. They laughed at my frank expression of plain cowardice. As a matter of practice, we don't go about it that way. Every new pupil retires with me into our little sanctum, where we make our experiments and first essays at creation in seclusion. So there's no embarrassment at all. Of course, my dear friend, I know that, but all the same I don't somehow think I should make a great success of it, I affirmed.
Would there be, do you think, a vacancy of any sort for another learner? Asked Roger, because, if so, I should very much like to become one, said the gardener, finishing Roger's sentence for him. There's plenty of room, and to spare. But before we go into that, let me finish off this tulip. It won't take a moment.
So. He held the tulip in his hand, and instantly we saw a flash of light descend upon it. It came and was ended almost before he realized it. "Now," said he, "we have something very different. Smell." He gently waved the flower to and fro before us, and we were at once aware of the most subtle perfume. "Place your hands round the bloom, friend Roger." Roger did so. "Why," he said, "it's alive. I can feel the what is it, sort of electricity question mark running up my arms. No, it's not electricity, but it is power. That is actually the life you feel, and it's passing some on to you, for your benefit. We have not finished yet. Put the pot on the table, then take hold of the stem of the plant, and give it a little shake, as though you were trying to shake a drop of water off the petals. That's the way." As Roger performed this simple action, a most perfect sound issued forth, as of the striking of a small silvery bell, of clear and sweet tone. He repeated the experiment over and over again, such was his surprised delight. "Do all the flowers make that sound when this is done to them?" he asked. "All the flowers, and many other things beside. The water, for instance. You can bring out some lovely sounds from that when it is disturbed. But before the tulip was given life, it was silent. Well, now, you would like to join us. We shall be delighted to have you whenever you feel disposed to come. Ruth and Monsignor are showing you round for the present. There's plenty of time. See the world, our world first, eh, Monsignor?" "That is so, Roger," I said. "Do you feel you want to start here immediately?" "Oh, no, not this instant." "Good, then we can continue our perambulations, and see some more, and then our friend will be happy to make you one of his pupils. I can give you any details that you might want to know, without taking up too much of our friend's time." And so that matter was pleasantly settled, and another happy soul made happier still. 11. The man in the cottage. "You mentioned other places, Monsignor," remarked Roger, "places that are not pleasant, as these are." "That is so, Roger," I replied. "Where are they?" "As to their precise location, well, that is not so easy defined. As I expect you've noticed, the four points of compass have no significance in these realms or anywhere else in the spirit world. That, as you will remember, was matter that might have cropped up when you once asked if it were possible to lose oneself here. Still, we could soon take you to those unpleasant places." "Do you really wish to see them?" The boy was silent for a moment. "Perhaps I had better guided by Ruth and yourself, I mean, guided by your advice. Then, my dear boy, if you wish for our suggestions, sure Ruth will agree with me that it were much better that you keep away from the dark regions for some time yet." "Monsignor is perfectly right, Roger. Don't go there. You know we will do anything for you that we possibly can. Those beastly regions are not for you yet. Later on, perhaps. Accept our word for it. There is thousands who could corroborate us that you wouldn't feel at all happy about it afterwards. You know how, on earth, deep curiosity will lead us towards looking at something or other we were pretty sure we should afterwards regret having seen. We would in, and our first impressions become verified. Here's just such another instance. There's this can be said, Roger. Those dark realms are not the theological hell to which people are condemned for all eternity once in, never out again. Every person, who at present is an inhabitant of those terrible places, has the free choice to emerge from them whenever he changes his mind. He can work his way out in precisely the same way as we can work our way from these lovely lands into still lovelier. The law is the same there as here, and applies to us all there and here. And here is a living witness to what I say. Do you see that trim cottage over there, Roger, with the two tall trees near it? Well, I'm revealing no secrets when I tell you that the dweller in that cottage once lived in an awful hovel, not actually in the dark realms, but in the dismal, bleak regions that lie close to them, the sort of twilight of the dark lands themselves. Ah, our friend has seen us. We had perceived the owner of the cottage sitting in his garden, and now he was waving to us. Shall we take Roger to see him, Monsignor? Ruth suggested. That would be a capital notion, my dear, if Roger doesn't mind listening to our friend's story. It's not a long one, nor is it frightening or anything of that sort. But I must tell you this, that it was largely due to Ruth that he was able to turn the corner, as it were, and emerge from his unhappiness. So you can readily imagine that he regards Ruth as something only very slightly less than an archangel. Ruth laughed.
Well, said Roger, I think that the gentleman is entirely right. He's a very good judge, anyway. I can easily understand how he feels, for both of you have done so much for me already, even in this short period.
No, my boy. We have done nothing that millions of sea would not have done. But we must spare Ruth blushes. I'll tell you what, Roger. If you feel like listening a friend's story, you will be doing him a very good turn. B. He feels that he owes so much for the help he's been that he can't do enough in return, and telling others about rehabilitation, he believes, is some small way of showing gratitude. Bless him, his heart's in the right place, and find he doesn't spare himself, either. I thought for a moment you were going to say D spares the horses.
Roger.
How could you? Exclaimed Ruth. If Morn ever puts that down on paper and he's liable to what I some of the earth folk say?
Trivial rubbish, my dear, all of it, I said. I hope won't think, Roger, from what I've said about our friend that he's a trying old boar.
Far from it. But in this case you will find his simple story will answer a number of questions for you without your having to ask them. And if I didn't know otherwise I should say that will give you a great deal of bother, one way and another, said with a grin.
Glorious, Roger, that's a good one against Monsignor Ruth. He included you in that statement, Ruth, I pee out.
By this time we were within hailing distance of our and he came rapidly towards us.
Ruth, Monsignor, he cried with evident delight, a pleasure. It seems a long time since I saw you both who are our young friend. I've not had the pleasure of him before. We introduced Roger, and explained that one of the reasons why we had not seen him of late was that we were showing Roger round his new land.
How are you? Asked Truth.
Why, my dear, I never felt better in my life.
Is it possible, do you think, for us ever to feel better than we do now?
That's something I should very much like to know as well, sir, said Roger.
There you are, my dear. Here's this young gentleman firmly supports me in my demand. Now then, what does that wise head say?
Our friend slipped his arm through Roger's.
Why, I don't know, Ruth answered with a smile, but I don't see how we could feel any better than we do already. Perhaps it's all a matter of comparison.
That must be it, and compared with what I once felt, this is perfection. It might be called paradise regained, if I were at all sure that I ever had it to lose and regain. But come inside, and let our new friend see what a spirit world country cottage looks like. This small dwelling was as neat and trim inside as it was outside, and everything was arranged with the greatest taste and refinement, and with yet an eye upon solid comfort and enjoyment. In the apartment which we entered directly from the garden, the furniture was of the ancient style, well constructed and pleasant to behold. It was kept in a high state of polish, and reflected the large bowls of flowers that were everywhere displayed. The other rooms, both upstairs and down, were similarly appointed, and altogether the whole dwelling revealed the natural pride and devoted care of its owner.
I have no shame in telling you, Roger, my friend, that this is a very different place from the one I inhabited when I first came into the spirit world, as Ruth and Monsignor will tell you, and, of course, Edwin.
Where is Edwin, now?
Why isn't he with you?
He has been very busy of late, Ruth replied, and none of us has seen much of him beyond a fleeting visit.
Roger was one of our own cases. Do you like being referred to as a case, Roger? And we thought we would take time off and show him things.
Doing for him, what Edwin did for you and Monsignor.
Do you remember your first visit to me? But of course you do.
I shall never forget it.
If you feel so disposed, tell Roger about it.
Our friend reflected for a moment.
Why, yes, if you wish, he said, but he should know first how I came to live in such a place, such an awful place, as it was. When I lived on Earth, Roger, I was a successful businessman. Business was my preoccupation in life, for I thought of precious little else, and I considered all means right in my dealings with others, provided such means were strictly legal. As long as they were that, I deemed the rest did not matter. I was ruthless, therefore, in gaining my ends, and coupled with a high degree of efficiency, I achieved great commercial success. In my home, there was only one person to be thought of, and that was myself. The rest of the family did as they were told and I did the telling. I always gave generously to charity when I thought I should derive the greatest benefit and credit for myself, for I did not believe in anonymity as far as I was concerned. If any donations were to be given, I saw to it that my name was sufficiently prominent. Of course, I supported the church in the district where I lived, and at my own expense had some portions added to the building, with proper emphasis upon the donor. The house I occupied was my own, and of such size and always have the last word, so to speak. He simply marched out of the house and left me when I became too intractable. At length he returned, but this time not alone, for he brought with him two friends, and another whom I had sometimes seen in the area, the same two friends who are looking after you, Roger Monsignor and Ruth. Glancing back now, I know that visit was the turning point. Ruth and Monsignor stood in my room, very discreetly in the background, while Edwin spoke to me. I began to feel a trifle less angry, and my eyes were continually drawn towards Ruth, when I had first glimmerings of light, if I may so express it. Ruth's presence served to remind me that I had a daughter of my own, though I had treated her equally abominably with the rest. There was no physical resemblance between Ruth and my daughter, it was more one of temperament, as far as I could judge. Whatever it was, I already began to feel differently. That, combined with all that Edwin had spoken to me on so many occasions, had its effect. After my visitors had gone, a terrible loneliness came over me, as well as deep, dark remorse, so intense that I cried aloud in my despair for Edwin's presence now, which I had so often spurned with contempt, for I had put in some good thinking. You can imagine my joy and surprise when I perceived Edwin coming towards the house almost upon the instant of my cry. I met him at the door, and as he would tell you himself, I was a changed man. The first thing I did was to thank him for coming so expeditiously, and I was not much accustomed to thanking people for anything. The next was to apologize to him for all I had said and done to him. But he waved my words aside with a brilliant smile upon his face that clearly bespoke his great pleasure that, at last, I was on the way to being something very different from the inflated egoist and spiritual blackguard that I was when I arrived in the spirit lands. Edwin at once sat down with me and proceeded to discuss ways and means of getting me out of the hellhole that was my abode. A course of action was decided upon. Edwin did the deciding, for I put myself entirely in his hands, and for the present it was arranged that I should remain where I was for a brief while, and that I had but to call him and he would come. After he had gone, I gazed round upon my house, and in some extraordinary manner it seemed much brighter than it was. It was unquestionably less dingy, and my clothes were less shabby, and that discovery helped to make me feel a great deal happier. I will not bore you with all the struggles, hard struggles, I had to make up for all that was past. It was hard work, but I never lacked friends. I don't need to look farther than this room to see to, at least. Well, Roger, you see me now, as unlike my old self as day is to night, still working hard, and glad of it. My work? Why, doing for others what Edwin did for me and for the same kind of people. It's easier to handle them when you've been one of them yourself, our host added with a chuckle. There's one consolation, he went on, they've pretty well forgotten about me on Earth. Otherwise they'd think of me as being far worse than old Scrooge, and would point out that, at the last, Scrooge reformed and became a decent citizen, while I went to my end unrepentant. Perfectly true. But they don't know that I've changed my views somewhat since then, and they'd not know me for the man I was. Still, maybe they'll find out one day, and, my word, there'll be surprises all round. 12. Philosopher's Folly. Would you, Roger, describe these realms of the spirit world as a dreary imitation of the earth? I asked our young friend good gracious. No. Who even said they were? The particular gentleman I have in mind, though not the only one of his kind, lives on Earth, and is regarded by his friends, and one or two people who make money out of him, as a philosopher,